Local News, Culture, and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, activists arrested as PennDOT begins preparations to take down the Skinners Falls Bridge. Local protests are ramping up, and an 86-year-old protester was arrested Friday. Liam Mayo from The River Reporter is here with the latest. Scribblewits, the secret history of funny women. From back in time and around the world, we'll meet some of the witty women of history with author Busy Coy during Women's History Month. Eating upstate with Erin Shearer, she has a preview of The Ridge by Millhouse, a new restaurant opening this week in Ulster County, and local economic perspective from our own James B. Huntington. It's coming up, but first the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Israeli military has struck a major hospital in southern Gaza, killing a senior Hamas official. Gaza health authorities say a teenage boy was also killed. This is one of the latest Israeli airstrikes that have killed more than 600 Palestinians since Israel broke a ceasefire last week. NPR's Anas Baba reports from Gaza.
The Israeli military struck one of the last functioning hospitals in southern Gaza. The military says it was targeting a senior Hamas figure inside the hospital. Hamas says the official had been receiving medical treatment at that time. Gaza's health officials say the strike set fire to part of the hospital, wounded hospital staff, and killed a teenage patient. It came on a day of intensive Israeli bombardment, which sounded like this. Health officials said six members of one family were killed. They were sleeping in the tent. This is part of Israel's strategy to pressure Hamas into releasing hostages under terms that align with its own interests. Anas Baba, NPR News, Gaza.
This afternoon, a federal appeals court will take up President Trump's appeal to block a lower court judge's orders to release information about recent deportation flights. U.S. District Court Judge James Boasberg wants to know why Trump used a wartime power to deport hundreds of migrants when the U.S. is not at war. He wants to know if the government violated his orders to stop the flights. President Trump has bashed the judge in online writings. U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi says she thinks the U.S. Supreme Court will have to step in.
These judges are out of control. We are going to fight back, and we are going to win. And the Supreme Court will be ready to hear these cases.
She spoke to Fox News. The wife of Vice President Vance is scheduled to travel to Greenland this week with President Trump's National Security Advisor, Mike Waltz. Greenland is a territory of Denmark. NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports their trip comes as President Trump continues to push for the U.S. to take control of the world's largest island.
Usha Vance will travel to Greenland with one of her children and a U.S. delegation on Thursday to visit historical sites and learn about Greenlandic heritage, according to the White House. They'll also attend Greenland's national dog sled race. Waltz will separately visit a U.S. military base in Greenland this week as well, according to a White House official. The visits come as Trump has continued to say the U.S. will acquire the territory, despite leaders in Denmark and Greenland rejecting that. The territory is rich in natural resources, and Trump says the U.S. needs it for international security. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News.
On Wall Street, stocks are sharply higher this hour. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 1%, or 480 points. The Nasdaq is up 326 points. That's about 1.75%. You're listening to NPR. British authorities are questioning the officials of London's Heathrow Airport. It shut down for 18 hours Friday after losing power. There was a fire at a nearby substation. But British electricity officials say the privately owned airport had other power options. Heathrow is a major airline hub that connects continents. Tens of thousands of passengers had their flights disrupted. A jury in Georgia has found international company Bayer liable in a case involving its weed killer Roundup. The jury ordered Bayer to pay more than $2 billion in damages to a man who claims the weed killer caused his cancer. Comedian Conan O'Brien received the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor last night at the Kennedy Center. NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports comedians who were there joked about O'Brien and also about President Trump's recent takeover of the Kennedy Center.
John Mulaney said he first became a fan of Conan O'Brien's watching him on TV when he was 11.
You showed me how a bizarre Catholic man who presents well but is deeply troubled on the inside could navigate the entertainment industry.
Other comedians who paid tribute were Nikki Glaser, Adam Sandler, Sarah Silverman, Tracy Morgan, and Will Ferrell. And a number of them made jokes about President Trump ousting Kennedy Center leaders and ending up chair of the board himself. Conan O'Brien said that accepting an award named for Mark Twain was a responsibility.
Twain wrote, "Patriotism is supporting your country all of the time and your government when it deserves it."
Elizabeth Blair, NPR News, Washington.
And I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. An 86-year-old was arrested on Friday during attempts to disrupt the demolition of the Skinner's Falls Bridge. That's the bridge that crosses the Delaware River, connecting the communities of Milanville, Pennsylvania, and Skinner's Falls, New York. Sheila Dugan, who lives near the bridge, was charged with criminal trespass and disorderly conduct.
I'm not happy that nobody's standing with me on the bridge. I'm on the bridge to save the bridge. I want to save the bridge. I don't like to tear the bridge down. And if they tear it down, I'll be very unhappy about it.
The Pennsylvania Department of Transportation, or PennDOT, plans to demolish the historic Skinner's Falls Bridge, saying that it's badly deteriorated and at risk of imminent collapse. PennDOT says the bridge will come down mid-April. Liam Mayo has been covering the story of the Skinner's Falls Bridge for the River Reporter, and he joins us now. Liam, good morning.
Good morning, Tim.
Thanks for joining us. And let's remind folks a little bit more about the background of the Skinner's Falls Bridge and why its demolition is such a controversial issue for the local community.
So the Skinner's Falls Bridge, originally constructed in 1902, is a historic landmark. I believe it is on the National Registry for Historic Places, Natural Historic Registry. And it has been closed to vehicle traffic since 2019 due to sort of already observed deterioration of the bridge. And there were sort of previous closings and issues with the bridge even before that. Over those past couple of years, since 2019, PennDOT has been, in theory, conducting surveys of the community, asking if they want to see the bridge preserved, if they want to see the bridge replaced. And the community has been very vocal in saying, we want to see this bridge preserved. Fast forward to 2024, when PennDOT does a couple of more investigations of the bridge, it looks at the bridge a little more closely and says, actually, although we've been saying that we could preserve the bridge, our most recent findings have found there's this advanced state of deterioration, and so the bridge isn't safe anymore. There's no safe way to preserve it, so we have to take it down. That's kind of why the bridge being torn down is controversial. People feel that they were misled by PennDOT throughout that entire period, that PennDOT didn't do the maintenance it needed to do on the bridge, and that it pretended it was considering historic preservation while it failed to do the maintenance that would make historic preservation possible, and which has led to this current situation where the bridge is in such a bad state that it could collapse on its own at any time. And that PennDOT has determined that the only safe way to proceed from here is to take the bridge down on its own.
Let's talk about Sheila Dugan. She lives nearby, and she was arrested on Friday for criminal trespass and disorderly conduct. Can you tell us about some of the events that led up to her arrest on Friday? What were the key moments? I think prior to that, she was like one of the only protesters there, right?
Yeah. And I believe she was on Friday as well. The clip we played earlier was from her standing at the bridge on Wednesday. I was there at that time. She was standing on the Pennsylvania side of the bridge, so on the opposite side of the bridge from where active construction is taking place, and she was standing past the caution tape that had been placed to warn people away from the bridge. And she basically took up a position there, and for, I'd say, around an hour, roughly, refused to move from that space, saying that she was making a stance for the bridge's preservation. Eventually, people convinced her to come away from the bridge. The same sort of thing happened on Thursday, where she went to the bridge and refused to move and eventually left of her own accord. But then the next day, Friday, she returned to the bridge again. According to the press release from the Pennsylvania State Police, she went past the barriers and signs preventing entry to the Pennsylvania side of the bridge and entered an active work zone. So on this sort of third day of individual protesting, the Pennsylvania State Police did arrest her. They processed her at the PSP barracks in Honesdale, and they released her. I spoke with her after that took place, and she told me, quote, "The experience wasn't new. I've been arrested before." I believe she has this, a history of activism going back to the 50s and 60s, and was very insistent that this was her way of sending a message to PennDOT, to Governor Shapiro, to the authorities who have determined that this bridge needs to be torn down, that it can be saved and that it still needs to be saved.
She also mentioned she'll continue protesting, quote, with whatever it takes. Do you think that there's a specific outcome she hopes to achieve, or is it more about raising awareness at this point?
She absolutely hopes that the bridge can still be saved, or that's what she said her goal is, that she hopes to get people to listen and to save the bridge. Speaking with other members of the community, I think that is a broader sentiment shared. The community around the bridge does still want to see the bridge preserved, but there's an element of fatalism sinking in a little bit. One of the people I spoke with said, to me, it feels like a train moving fast forward without an emergency brake. So essentially, while people would want to see the bridge preserved and they're going to keep fighting to see the bridge preserved, it's hard. It's getting harder to imagine PennDOT pulling the emergency brake on this project and changing course toward preservation.
There was a more organized gathering, I think, on Saturday. What do you know about that event?
Yeah, that was, I believe, around 20 to 30 people organized to stand very deliberately on the legal side of the line, so not crossing that caution tape, but just to be present, talk about the bridge, sort of raise the awareness of the bridge.
I wonder. And, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, that was all.
Yeah, so I just want to play a little bit more of the conversation you had with Sheila. Was this on Wednesday last week?
Yes, this was on Wednesday.
A little bit more about what motivated her to protest.
The Skinner's Falls Bridge is the oldest bridge up on the whole Upper Delaware. And they're going to tear it down for no reason. They need to fix it. There's a hole in it somewhere.
Okay.
And they need to fix it. They should fix it. And I'm on the board just telling them they should fix it. That's all.
Do you think they'll listen?
Yes. Yes, they will listen, I think.
So I wanted to play that because are they listening? What does PennDOT say?
PennDOT so far hasn't really commented. PennDOT is sort of moving forward as it had originally planned. The most recent we've heard is that they're still a couple of weeks away from being able to take down the bridge, so potentially late April, early May. There's still some work to be done before they could get to that point. So an exact timeline is kind of yet to be determined. But PennDOT throughout, sort of since this was originally announced in December that they were planning to demolish the bridge, they've been insistent in saying, hey, our engineering And what we're seeing from the condition of the bridge tells us that this bridge isn't safe, tells us that the bridge is just going to continue to deteriorate to the point where if we do nothing, it's just going to collapse on its own in a way that is very unsafe for everyone around it. And at least so far, they've said nothing to draw back from that position or to temper it all.
And has state government weighed in at all about the protest of the bridge?
Nothing so far as we've heard, no.
I know that some folks were organizing a call campaign to Governor Shapiro's office, Governor Josh Shapiro of Pennsylvania. No response there that we have heard of. Do you anticipate these protests to continue to grow leading up to the demolition? I mean, Sheila being the only one, I guess if one or two people come, that's growing. But I mean, are more people getting organized as you get closer to the date for this bridge to come down?
I think it's entirely possible. I think whether or not there are more arrests is one question. I think that's impossible to know. But I think people will absolutely keep turning up at the bridge, will keep trying to raise awareness about the bridge. And I just wanted to mention for people who may not have this foremost in their mind, part of the reason people are trying to reach out to Governor Shapiro on this is the governor signed an emergency declaration that sort of cleared the way for the destruction of the bridge to happen. He signed an emergency declaration in December that sort of helped PennDOT fast track some of the permitting they needed to do to take this bridge down safely. So people are asking him to basically reconsider that decision. Because he's already weighed in on it, they're hoping they can reach him and get him to reconsider or get him to weigh in on it again.
So far, no response that we've heard of. You, as I said, have been covering this story. You've spoken to a lot of people. What are other residents and business owners nearby saying about the bridge and its imminent removal?
I mean, there's a lot of remembrance. People who've lived there all their lives, remembering sort of how much the bridge meant to them. A lot of people saying that they would use the bridge often to go back and forth across the river. People saying, you know, there are people who have homes on one side of the river and businesses on the other side of the river, and not having a crossing there, sort of regardless of the bridge's historic nature, not having a working crossing there is a huge inconvenience for these people. But there are also people who are saying that this is a great asset to the community for its historic nature, kind of separate from any transportation use. People are saying that they would want this bridge preserved, even if it could only be preserved as like a pedestrian bridge or more as a historic landmark than a like highway bridge. And people who are saying that if the bridge comes down, they're not sure if there's going to be another bridge there, and they're not sure if they want another bridge there, just because this bridge and its historic nature fits so well into the landscape, fits so well into the character of the place, and it's hard to imagine a more sort of modern, big structure fitting in as well to that place.
Sheila Dugan told you she'd been arrested before and it wasn't a big deal. Did she tell you whether she was going to go back out there and protest?
She said that she would, yes, but so far it's been a couple of days and I've not heard that she has been arrested again. So I expect, to see her back out there, to see her continue to advocate for the bridge. But again, this particular avenue of it may or may not reoccur.
That's Leah Mayo, reporter for The River Reporter, reporting on protester Sheila Dugan, who was arrested Friday during attempts to disrupt the removal of the Skinners Falls Bridge. You can read his reporting at riverreporter.com. Liam, thank you so much, and I'm sure we'll be talking to you again as we move forward with this.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, Busy Coy, the humorist and author, and her take on Women's History Month. This is Radio Chatskill.
I am Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, to most people, the rat is vile and villainous, but not to everyone.
They make great pets, honestly.
We hear from those who have befriended and worked with rats.
A rat looks you in the eye and doesn't feel inferior or superior. It's just, you are like me. I'm like you.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Tuesday at 1 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
This station keeps you informed and keeps things in perspective.
Life is just one 10-minute experience after another. You don't want to underrate the power of these small little gestures.
I do believe that the universe is chaos and our role in it, which is, I think, the beauty and the agony of life, is to make sense of it.
We promise to keep helping you make sense of it all. Donate to this station today, and thank you.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. In 1884, Richard Grant White of The Critic wrote that humor was, quote, that rarest of qualities in a woman, end quote. That's to say, women aren't funny. Author Busy Coy begs to differ. Her Scribblewits project shows us that women are funny and that there's thousands of years of evidence to prove it. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke to Busy Coy about the secret history of funny women.
Welcome, Busy, to Radio Chatskill.
Thanks for having me, Valerie.
Well, we are delighted to have you and delighted that you're here to discuss this project that you embarked upon 4 or 5 years ago called Scribblewits. And folks can see that and more on your website, which is
BizzyCoy.com. That's BizzyCoy.com.
I love the way you titled it. A Secret History of Funny Women from Back in Time, Illuminated by Busy Coy. And I loved that illuminated because you do illuminate.
Thank you. Yeah, this project is a self-imposed research project for me to discover funny women from all across different historic time periods and all around the world. I used the word illuminated to describe my part of this project because there are actual academic researchers who have uncovered and quote unquote discovered these women, these funny women who have kind of fallen out of mainstream history. And so I didn't want to take all the credit for quote unquote discovering or writing about them, but I did feel like I did my part by simply illuminating them just a little bit by putting them and their stories onto my website.
And it should be said that you do have references for folks to go to.
Yeah. The project really is composed of, right now there's 32 stories about 32 women, and you can click on the story or the woman that interests you. And then there's a short article about her that I've written that I've tried to infuse my own humor into, so it's not just a dry academic history of a woman. It is bringing my own personality to it. But then at the end, I do link to the academic resources and journals where I found this information. The shocking thing to me is there's not a lot of reference material about any of these 32 women because some of them existed in ancient times and there simply just isn't a lot written about them. And in other cases, I think people just did not think they were important enough to document. So I give a lot of credit to the researchers who did do the work to find and investigate these funny women.
What did you discover, especially about those in ancient times?
Well, what's interesting is there's been funny women since the beginning of women. So all the way back to, we have evidence in ancient Greece of a couple of funny women, and I'm sure there were many more. Two that particularly caught my eye was a woman called Sulpicia, who was a writer, who was a poet, and what she wrote was called satire. Now, satire, the way we know it now, where we're sort of poking fun at something, is not what satire was in ancient Greece. It was a form of poetry, but it often did have a humorous angle to it, but different from the way we think of satire today. Sulpicia is known as the only female satirist of ancient Greece on record. Only two lines of her satirical poetry remain, and they're have very little meaning for us today because they're truly scraps, not even full sentences. But it caught my eye that, you know, this woman made her way all the way from ancient Greek times to today. The fact that there is a remnant of her that remains is amazing. Another woman from ancient times who was a funny woman was called Julia the Elder. Now, she was kind of a socialite of her day. I think of her as the Kim Kardashian or even a Paris Hilton of her time. She was the daughter of a wealthy ruler, and she lived a bombastic, flashy, flamboyant lifestyle. And she got into a lot of trouble, which is what I like about her. Back in the day, sort of tales of her extravagant exploits, often of a sexual nature, became sort of the stuff of modern day legend of the time. And so jokes and lines and comebacks and repartee made its way into the common language that were attributed to her. Things about all of her pregnancies, things about her children, things about her lovers. There were these little quotes and jokes in the zeitgeist of the time that were attributed to the wild and bombastic Julia the Elder.
And you also reference a number of female jesters as well as female clowns. Can you talk about them a little bit?
So there were female court jesters, which people might not know. One of them that I found particularly dynamic was Mathurine, who existed in 16th century and 17th century France. And she was known to be a jester to King Henry IV. Now, King Henry IV was a very unpopular king.
Yes.
And he had many attempts on his life. And the reason this female jester is known to us is because there is a story that she saved his life from one of these assassination attempts. Now, it's probably all been twisted over time, so we don't really know what happened. But the story is that a man broke into the king's chambers with a knife, and Mathurine was the one to block him from the king. We don't know what that really entailed or whether she just stood there or whether she attacked him and threw him out the window. We don't know. But she found her way into the history books, not only for being funny, for being a jester, but for saving the king's life.
It's interesting to discover that the false notion that women aren't funny goes way back through the ages, while funny women also go back through the ages.
Absolutely. There's been funny women since there have been women. And at the same time, there have been people saying women aren't funny since there have been women. I think some of that might have to do with the fact that humor is power. And if we can tell women they don't have that power, then that's a little piece of power we strip away from ourselves.
That's an interesting insight. Can you talk a little bit about Kate Sanborn? She wrote The Wit of Women.
Yes. So you said people have been saying women aren't funny for a long time. And Kate Sanborn is a woman who pushed back against that notion in a book that she wrote in 1885 called The Wit of Women. The Wit of Women was her response, was Kate Sanborn's response to an article that was published in The Critic magazine a year earlier in 1884, in which a critic said that humor was, quote, the rarest of qualities in women, which is a thinly veiled insult, saying of all the qualities women have, humor might be the rarest. And Kate Sanborn took great offense to that. And so she set about almost doing a project akin to what I feel my Scribblewits project is, where she set out to collect funny and witty and amusing writings from women and to compile them in that she called The Wit of Women. And that was a direct response to this article that she had read. And she even puts it in the book and talks about how that inspired her to show everybody, men and women, just how funny women are.
Are there any other funny women you'd like to tell our audience about before we conclude?
Yes. So one of the women that inspired me to start this project, I discovered while I was doing research for an application for the Fulbright program. And I was writing about humor writing, which is what I do. I do humor writing. And I was writing in my application about how I wanted to learn more about humor writers of history and funny women of history. And in putting that application together, I discovered a woman named Stella. And Stella was a dear, dear friend of a very famous humorist you might know called Jonathan Swift.
Mm-hmm.
Jonathan Swift wrote A Modest Proposal, which is still one of the most famous satirical pieces of all time, proposing that the rich should eat the poor, which was a fantastical thing to put in print in his day. So he was known for being incredibly funny. He also wrote Gulliver's Travels, other pieces that you know. But Jonathan Swift thought the funniest person he knew was his friend Stella, and he admired her wit so much that he collected what he called her bon mots. I don't know how you pronounce that in French. Somebody can pronounce it better than me. And he collected her 10 or more of her funniest sayings and jokes that he had recalled, and he put them into his book when he published it. So he included her in his own published book. And that was the only work she ever had published. And it was because he so admired her, he thought she deserved to be in print as well.
What a wonderful little story.
Yes, I was really inspired by learning that. And that really snowballed my journey of researching all of these women and realizing how many more there were. And every time I learned about one woman, it would send me to the path of another woman and another woman and another one. And then I had all of this research material. It was a wonderful gift.
And it's a wonderful gift to the audience.
Absolutely. And the fun of discovering them, I did want to share that fun with the audience. So I'm glad that came through and you enjoyed it yourself.
Yes. And you can tell us your website again and what else is on your website, because you've got quite a bit on there.
Yes. So you can go directly to ScribbleWits by going to scribblewits.org. And that's ScribbleWits.org. You can also go to my website that has all of my work on it, which is bizzycoy.com, BIZZYCOY.com. And on that website, you can buy my new book, Personal Space, which is a collection of my own funny writing, which is on sale now. You can see the events that I'm going to upcoming, yarn slingers, live readings, events of that sort. And you can read all of my published humor pieces that have been in places like The New Yorker, McSweeney's, and other websites. Those are all available for free on my website.
Well, thank you so much, Busy Coy, for coming in. And thank you so much for embarking on this project. It's really a treat.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome.
Culture reporter Valerie Manzi speaking to local author Busy Coy. We'll take a break. And when we come back, local economic perspective from our own James B. Huntington. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of On Point. Each hour of On Point is a journey to help make complicated issues understandable. Every issue brings more questions, like how did we get here? Why is this happening? And what does it mean? And how do we fix it? So let's figure this out and make sense of the world together. Join me weekday mornings at 11 here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, it's Monday, and that's time to check in with our own James B. Huntington. The Fed's keeping rates steady while warning of increasingly uncertain economic realities. What does it all mean for us? James B. is here. James B., good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
Well, James B., thanks for getting in here this Monday morning to let us know what's going on. I mentioned an uncertain economic outlook. What did the Fed have to say about it with interest rates last week?
Well, they left interest rates the same, which was obvious. The second choice, in fact, would have been raising them. But we have no idea what's going on. Things are mid-range. We have no idea what tariffs or what international policies may take effect that will affect the economy, but otherwise the numbers are calling it pretty much the same. So real GDP, the estimates are down from 2.1% at the end of the year down to 1.7%. So unemployment is expected to be a little worse than they thought it would be, and a little worse than it is now, up to 4.4% in December. Last time they thought 4.3, it's about 4.1 now. So they're expecting things will be worse, but they're really treading quite carefully about what is going to come out of our federal government, because we don't know. We also don't know the responses from other countries, so possible tariff increases, establishing tariffs, but they come and they go and they change every day. So the Fed really doesn't know much about what to do here.
But what we do know is that with these key borrowing rates in that target range of 4.25 to 4.5% there, if you're thinking about financing a big ticket purchase or renovating your home, that means those borrowing costs are still going to stay pretty high, right?
Yeah, stay much the same. If you see it as high or low, depends on what time in the past you're thinking of. So otherwise, it's, yes, I advise that if you are having a big money spending decision to make, if you're happy with how much it would cost you now, if you're okay with that, then go ahead and do it, because rates could go up. On the other side, if you're not really happy, if you think it's just too expensive, then hold off, because rates could go down.
What unusual problems are being faced by the Federal Reserve?
Well, I mentioned them before, actually. It's not knowing what is going to happen as far as these tariffs and such. We know, or it seems likely, that the cost of any tariffs is going to come to consumers. It's going to raise inflation higher. But we don't know what ones are going to stay. We have some 25% with Canada in place and some 10% with China in place. But we don't know which are going to stay, which are going to be here even in a week, let alone in 3 or 6 months. So they're focusing, as they or the chair Powell said quite aptly, that they're focusing on separating the signal from the noise when it came from federal policies. But really, you need a crystal ball more than you need any forecasting, because it's just too much up in the air as far as what is going to go on here. Yeah. So there, we may have some things that are wrong. For example, the administration could really punish the Fed and the rest of us by putting in lots and lots of tariffs. And we would have said, well, the Fed obviously should have raised rates. But how would they know? And it's just too uncertain, and it's really not based on a lot of facts. It's based on too many variables. And they don't know what to deal with for sure. So they're really, along with the rest of us, are going to be guessing. They don't have any inside scoop as to what Washington is going to be doing in June. because they have no inside information, very little inside information about what moves are going to be made or attempted or threatened and then withdrawn and so on. So it just, it seems like they're saying the right things, they're perceiving the right things, and now the best they can do is keep everything the same.
Yeah, perhaps the best action is no action at all in this uncertain time. How?
Well, just live your life. Keep doing what you're going to do. Don't be stopped by this. I wouldn't be terribly scared by this. I would just go ahead and continue to function because the economy will do what's logically likely given the policies, but it may not do anything if there are no real changes going on. So the chance of it really going down the john really totally seems small to me because, as I've said before, I think the tariffs are really a bargaining chip. They're a lever to try to get other things from different countries, and they will be withdrawn if our president gets what he wants.
Well, let's talk about those other countries. How are these potential tariffs affecting other countries' economies?
Well, there's quite a bit of reductions going on in estimated growth around the world. We have, countries in Europe are looking for still lower. They're expecting to go up 1% this year and maybe 1.2% next year. Mexico is actually expecting to shrink economically. They're all being damaged, or Mexico especially is possibly going to be damaged by tariffs, which, for what it's worth, Trump said he would impose another round of tariffs next month. No, I don't know if it means it will happen. I doubt very much it means he will have them, but it means he'll threaten them and go from there. So we have some countries doing well. India is not as affected. They're not being mentioned for specific tariffs on certain countries. Their economy grew 6.3%, and they're expecting it'll be a tenth of a percent higher than that this year and a couple more tenths next year. So China seems to be better. They're projecting 4.8% this year and 4.4% next year. But if the tariffs got really heavy on China, it will substantially hurt them. I know they're selling their things around the world, but the U.S. is the largest possible market for them.
Let's talk locally. We've got a couple of big job fairs coming up. One is the Working Pike Job Fair, and then there's a SUNY Sullivan Job Fair. Let's start with that Working Pike County Job Fair. When's that coming up, and how many employers will they have there?
This is going to be April 1st. That's a week from tomorrow, from 10 to 2, at the Best Western Inn at Hunt's Landing in Matamoros. They have 70 employers scheduled to attend. That's a whale of a lot for a job fair, folks. They're mentioning healthcare, hospitality, finance, manufacturing, law enforcement and corrections, sales, all as areas of special emphasis and special employees. So 10 to 2 on the first.
April 1st, yeah. And then the SUNY Sullivan Job Fair is coming up. When's that? And then how many folks
do
they have there?
Guess what, folks? That's also on the 1st. And it's from 10 to 1 instead of 10 to 2.
You could hit both. You could hit both.
You could hit one and then the other. And if you, that would call on you to be focused in terms of what you're looking for. And if you want to go to both, then I would recommend going to the 10 to 1 one, the SUNY Sullivan one first, and then catching near the end or for the second half or the last hour or so of the Pike County one. So they also have a lot of employers. They have 40. I mean, I can run down the entire list of them real fast if you think we have time.
Well, I want to get to those numbers, so let's direct folks to the SUNY Sullivan website, also Pike County's government website for more information. But no fooling, on April 1st, two big job fairs taking place for folks and a lot of employers
out there.
Yeah, they
probably will have the names of the employers on at least one of these sites, hopefully both.
Well, let's get to those numbers. How is the stock market doing, and how did the prices change this morning and from last week?
Over the past week, as of early this morning, we have gold 3024 up 37. It broke 3,000. Congratulations. Silver $33.17, down about a half dollar, making the ratio 91-1. That ratio between silver and gold has been creeping up higher, but silver is still quite strong at that level. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, 41,985. It went up, but just a hair short of 500. Rebounded somewhat from some bad things going on recently. Lost 1,300 last week, but it did gain a chunk of that back. NASDAQ, 17,784. That's up 30 points, almost unchanged. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, $68.40 the barrel, up 63 cents, still looking good, still below 70. Bitcoin, 87,429, up 3,800 and some. It looks like it is rebounding, recovering from a time several weeks around 80. So that was a good one. British pound, 1.2959, up a tenth of a cent, almost unchanged. Euro, 1.0851, down about a third of a cent. Faded back a bit, but both of those two are quite strong. And the Japanese yen, 100 yen coin, is holding on at 67 cents. So in general, except for gold, we have really a neutral sort of week with things regressing, moving toward their previous levels. And this week, one way or the other, rates to have larger changes. So hang on.
We'll keep an eye on it for all of us. Is our own James B. Huntington, local author, local economist, and local savant. Thank you so much for providing some perspective for us, James B.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, listeners.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, Erin Shearer and her segment Eating Upstate with a new restaurant that's opening in Ulster County this week. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
The police knock on your door. They arrest you and accuse you of a crime. But you're innocent. What do you do?
People often say to me, oh, God, I would never confess to a crime I didn't commit. Well, that's myth number one. The answer to that is, yes, you might.
Why we admit to things we didn't do. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR. Today at 1 on Radio Catskill.
The NPR network informs and connects communities around the country, providing reliable information in times of crisis. Your support helps ensure that public radio remains freely available to everyone. Please make your gift to this station today. Here's how, and thank you.
Make your donation at wjffradio.org.
You're back with Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. After nearly 11 years in Poughkeepsie, the folks behind Millhouse Brewing Company are expanding with The Ridge by Millhouse in Highland, New York, a new restaurant, formerly The Gunk House. It's opening on Wednesday. And for her Eating Upstate segment, Erin Shearer got a preview of The Ridge and just ahead of its opening.
Since its opening in 2013, Millhouse Brewing has remained a mainstay in Poughkeepsie with its own unique takes on IPAs, Kolsches, and stouts that have won them numerous awards. This month, they are opening a new restaurant under the Millhouse umbrella, the Ridge by Millhouse, located at the former German restaurant Gunk House in Highland, Ulster County, and they're the subject of today's Eating Upstate. Head chef Daniel Crocco grew up in Hopewell Junction and graduated from the Culinary Institute of America. At 23, he opened his first restaurant, Brasserie 292 in Poughkeepsie, and has spent most of his adult career owning and operating restaurants. Brewmaster Jamie Bishop brewed as a hobby for many years while living in Brooklyn and working in geriatric sales before making the jump into brewing full-time when Millhouse Brewing Company opened in 2013. From the time of its inception, Millhouse Brewing won numerous awards for their beers in competitions like the New York Excelsior Governor's Cup. For many years, Bishop and Crocco have discussed opening a second restaurant under the Millhouse name, and when they learned that the Gunk House building would be going up for sale, they jumped at the chance. Here's Chef Daniel Crocco talking about making the decision to open a second restaurant.
The natural progression, right, of when you own restaurants is to own another one, right? And we saw an opportunity. We had always talked about maybe doing another Millhouse or maybe doing something else, but you learn from other people's mistakes sometimes, and opening up places that are hard to manage, when they're an hour away or 2 hours away, it's quite difficult. We're all myself and my management team are all quite, if you want to call it, alphas in terms of, the affect that we bring to the table. Is we all, we're all hard headed and very opinionated, and we all are quite good at what we do, and that's why we hire people like that. But we kind of noticed that being closer to, I would say our kind of ground zero, right, Millhouse Brewing Company at 289 Mill Street, would be easier to manage and keep the quality as high as possible without having to, imagine if we opened up a Millhouse Brewing Company in Westchester. It would, it's quite a hike to be able to manage that every day, especially for me. Like, I don't sleep much. I worked from 6 a.m. till about 5 at the new place, just doing things. And now I'm here back at 289 at Millhouse Brewing Company. So being able to kind of bounce back and forth, I live quite close, and Jamie lives actually like 5 minutes away from the new place, makes it pretty easy for us to kind of make sure we're touching the places as many times. Obviously, I'm always afraid of opening another place because people tend to put a microscope on you at, one or the other to make sure, they opened a second place, but the first place, it quote unquote went, it went to, and I never want that to happen. We've worked too hard for that to happen. And we put together such a great team here that we've been able to kind of focus our attention on getting this thing kind of rehabbed and fixed the way we want it to function for us. So it's quite a blessing, I would say. When you own restaurants in the same restaurant for a lot of years, sometimes it's nice to do something different.
Once Crocco and Bishop secured the building, Crocco set about building their new team. For Crocco, assembling a solid team takes precedence over creating the menu in the initial planning stages.
I've cooked for so long that the food is the easiest part for me. Putting delicious food on the plate is literally the easiest part. If you talk to any successful restaurant or any successful chef, that is one of the easiest parts. It's putting a team together. It's making sure the place flows correctly. It's making sure you have the guest in mind, the guest experience in mind. It's making sure your staff is in mind and how they work and where they're working and the environment that they're working and the team that you put together and the culture that you build around a business is so much more important to me and honestly the hardest thing to do. The food is the easy part. The food is anyone can make delicious food. We just happen to, as chefs, right, and cooks, we just have more practice at it, right? We cook every day. It's just like anything else. So making delicious food is, that's why menus for me comes like so far at the end. Not to mention, like, it's a, you know, when you build these, when you build restaurants, they're living being things. The menu I might start out with in, you know, when we open might be, it might be completely different from that in 4 months, you know? We will tailor some things to the guests and how the community receives what we do, and we'll, you know, we'll pivot and we'll change. And but I'm confident, because I've been doing it for long enough, that usually the things that I pick and kind of choose to serve, people really, you know, they really love, and I'm pretty confident in that. But I'm also not so overly ego driven that I, you know, sometimes you have to give the people what they want.
Among the dishes that the Ridge by Mill House will be serving include swordfish skewer, brown butter squash, chicken and dumplings gnocchi, the Ridge burger, pad thai kale salad, and desserts like ricotta cannoli crepes and peach brown sugar strudel. For those looking for other libations, the Ridge by Mill House will offer cocktails and concoctions such as their s'mores coffee. The Ridge by Mill House will also be offering Sunday brunch as well as a raw bar. Further down the road, Crocco plans to construct a new 50-foot bar.
I think that there's always a little bit of worry. You know, we've had 99% amazing feedback from people or press articles about people hearing about what's been going on, right? There's always a couple in there that are like, well, I hope you don't tear the place to the ground and ruin it, you know? And it's just, you know, those are the people that were always just like, if they only knew what we were doing to open a restaurant for a community over there, not to mention some of our loyal patrons over here in Poughkeepsie, if they only knew the amount of hard work and sacrifice and we're neglecting and putting ourselves through absolute misery, you know, right now, to move everything along as quickly as possible. I think that our hopes and dreams for the place are not just what happens right when we open. We have some really exciting ideas for the future. And for someone, you know, like you asked, something that we might not have talked to about with anyone is, yeah, I dream to put a 50-foot bar across the front of that deck staring at the mountains, because no one in the area will have something like that. And I think that to me is one of those things that would definitely set, you know, a place that already has an amazing view, you know, in way into the stratosphere of the guest experience. So that's a dream, and I'm hoping we can make that a reality in the spring before we open up for the summer season.
The Ridge by Mill House is located at 387 South Street in Highland. I'm Erin Shear. Eating Upstate is a production of WJFF Radio Catskill.
And that'll do it for this edition of Radio Catskill. A reminder that our spring fun drive starts a week from today. You may have received a letter in the mail, and if you did, go ahead and take the time, if you could, before we get started officially, to donate now. Go to WJFFradio.org or pop that letter with a check in there back in the mail. Public media faces an uncertain future, and your support is more important than ever. And as we face these challenges, your donations help ensure that our voice continues to thrive and remain independent no matter what the future holds. So thanks for helping us, and thanks for listening. I'm Tim Bruno.
Support comes from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy one degree at a time. More information at Sullivan180.org. From The River Reporter, the community newspaper covering four counties in Pennsylvania and New York along the Upper Delaware River. RiverReporter.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hi, this is Marco Werman, host of The World. Weekdays at 3, our newsroom connects you with events around the globe. Our reporters in the Americas, Africa, Europe, and Asia get to the heart of the day's news. We bring you international perspectives on issues worldwide and here in the U.S. It's 1 hour each day that broadens horizons and takes you beyond our borders. Join me on The World, afternoons at 3, on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, cloudy with a high of 45. Clouds hanging around for the next few days. Tonight's low 30. Cloudy with maybe some partial sunshine in the afternoon tomorrow, a high of 45. Looking ahead, Wednesday, Thursday, still cloudy, highs around 40 to the lower 40s. On Point is next.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.